York. This is Democracy Now!
We've been taught our entire life to just fit in, just be quiet, don't speak up, be invisible. If you are invisible enough, you will be seen as American. But we are here to say that we will be invisible no more.
No more!
We will speak up.
Speak up!
It's been a devastating year for many Asian Americans as hate crimes have spiked across the country, fueled in part by Donald Trump's racist rhetoric about COVID-19. We'll speak to guests in California and New York to look at how two states are responding. Then New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is facing mounting calls to resign or be impeached over sexual harassment allegations and his cover-up of thousands of COVID deaths in nursing homes. We'll speak to New York Assemblyman Ron Kim, who says Cuomo threatened to destroy him for speaking out.
Your March 25th order will kill people. That's what the workers were telling the governor. His response was to give the legal blanket corporate immunity, again, a license to kill. That was his response.
And we'll look at why some farm workers are facing an uphill battle to get vaccinated, even though they're essential workers who've risked their lives during the pandemic. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden says the U.S. will have enough coronavirus vaccines for all adults by the end of May. The statement comes after a deal was struck with Merck to help produce the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which U.S. residents started receiving Tuesday. Biden also announced a new plan to get educators vaccinated more rapidly.
We want every educator, school staff member, child care worker to receive at least one shot by the end of the month of March. To help make this happen, starting next week and for a month, the month of March, we'll be using our federal pharmacy program to prioritize the vaccination of pre-K through 12 educators and staff and child care workers.
Texas is lifting mask mandates and fully reopening businesses at 100% starting next week. Despite warnings from the Centers for Disease Control, it's still too early and cases could pick up again. Mississippi announced a similar move. On Capitol Hill, as the Senate moves to debate the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package, Senator Bernie Sanders announced he'll force a vote on an amendment to increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour and called on fellow senators to ignore the Senate parliamentarian's recommendation to remove it from the bill. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops advised Catholics to avoid getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, saying the company used abortion-derived fetal cells to create, test, and produce the shot. Fetal cells are not actually contained in the distributed vaccine, however, and Pope Francis and the Vatican have said they deem it morally acceptable to use cells from aborted fetuses in the research and production of vaccines. The cell line goes back to the 1970s. The White House has pulled Neera Tanden's nomination at her request to head the Office of Management and Budget after several key senators said they would not vote to confirm her. Biden said Tanden would still serve in his administration. Tanden came under fire from both the right and many progressives who opposed her cozy relationship with corporate America, her support for welfare cuts and aggressive foreign policy views. In other cabinet news, the Senate voted Tuesday to confirm Princeton University economist Cecilia Rouse, who will be the first Black woman to lead the Council of Economic Advisors. The Senate also confirmed Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo to lead the Commerce Department. At the time of her nomination, the Revolving Door Project said, quote, Raimondo has a record of promoting fracking and cuts to public assistance programs, selling public pensions to Wall Street and grossly mishandling Rhode Island's COVID-19 outbreak, unquote. Meanwhile, Seth Harris, the former acting labor secretary under President Obama, has reportedly been tapped as a top labor advisor. While working at the corporate law firm Dentons, Harris co-wrote a paper which helped shape California's anti-worker Prop 22, which exempts companies like Uber and Lyft from having to classify their workers as employees, depriving them of basic wage and labor protections. FBI Director Christopher Wray appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee Tuesday, where he defended the FBI's handling of intelligence in the lead-up to the January 6th insurrection. He also told lawmakers, quote, domestic terrorism has been metastasizing across the country, and rebuked a far-right lie that's also supported by a number of Republican lawmakers that the rioters were fake Trump or left-wing protesters.
We have not to date seen any evidence of anarchist violent extremists or people subscribing to Antifa in connection with the 6th. Racially motivated violent extremism is the biggest chunk of our domestic terrorism portfolio, if you will, overall.
D.C. law enforcement agencies are increasing security around the Capitol this week as QAnon supporters believe Trump will be inaugurated on March 4th as president of the United States, which they call True Inauguration Day. In Afghanistan, three women who worked for a local broadcast station were shot dead in the eastern city of Jalalabad while heading home from work Tuesday. The young women had reportedly all recently graduated from school. Local police said the Taliban was responsible, though the group denied involvement. At least 15 media workers have been killed in Afghanistan over the last 6 months. Protests erupted across Lebanon Tuesday after the value of the Lebanese pound plunged to a record low on the black market, the latest in the ongoing economic crisis. The turmoil has also triggered a fuel shortage that's led to extended power cuts. In some areas, people have been left without electricity for over 12 hours. In Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara, the family of a political prisoner who's been on hunger strike since early January were denied access to see him and warned he could be in critical condition or even dead. Mohamed Lamine Hadi has also reportedly been threatened with retaliation and death. This is Hadi's mother.
If he is still alive, they should allow us visiting him. And if he is dead, they should give us his remain. I will not move from here until to meet my son. Let them arrest or kill me or blow me away. I just can't bear life without him.
Hadi is part of a group of political prisoners who received harsh sentences after the violent dismantlement of the protest camp known as Gdeim Izik, which Noam Chomsky called the first uprising of the Arab Spring. Meanwhile, 100 Sahrawi organizations published an open letter to President Biden asking him to reverse Trump's recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. They write, "The issue of Western Sahara, the last colony in Africa, is easy to understand. It's not an ethnic conflict or a civil war, but a basic issue of decolonization not yet resolved." The Biden administration announced new sanctions against senior Russian officials Tuesday over last year's poisoning of nationalist opposition figure Alexei Navalny with the nerve agent Novichok. The sanctions also target the Russian military's intelligence agency and research groups thought to be involved in the production of chemical and biological agents. Reporters Without Borders has filed a criminal case against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the persecution and murder of Washington Post columnist and Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi. The case was filed in a German court days after the Biden administration declined to directly sanction the Crown Prince, even after releasing an intelligence report reaffirming bin Salman approved Khashoggi's murder. A new report by the International Energy Agency says global carbon dioxide emissions have not only returned to pre-pandemic levels, but have surpassed them by the end of last year. IEA's executive director said, quote, "If governments don't move quickly with the right energy policies, this could put at risk the world's historic opportunity to make 2019 the definitive peak in global emissions." The Biden administration's withdrawn an environmental review for a massive copper mine in eastern Arizona, temporarily blocking a multinational mining corporation, Resolution Copper, from taking over a parcel of land sacred to the San Carlos Apache Nation and other Native communities. The U.S. Forest Service said it needs more time to consult with Native people about the mine's impact on Oak Flat, an ancient forest with spiritual and cultural significance. Advocates say the proposed mine would destroy Oak Flat and contaminate a large swath of southern Arizona. Arizona Democratic Congressmember Raul Grijalva is set to reintroduce the Save Oak Flat Act, which would repeal the appropriation of the site. State Republicans around the country are ramping up the legislative attack on transgender rights. The Alabama Senate voted Tuesday to pass a bill that would make it a felony to provide gender-affirming care to trans youth. The bill now goes to the House. Meanwhile, Tennessee, Wisconsin, and North Dakota are just some of the states where Republicans are pushing bans on transgender students taking part in sports, with a bill likely to pass this week in Tennessee. Wisconsin's Democratic Governor Tony Evers is expected to block such an effort in Wisconsin. In California, at least 13 people are dead after a tractor trailer crashed into an SUV packed with over two dozen people in an agricultural area near the U.S.-Mexico border. Most of the victims were from Mexico, though further details remain unclear. Thousands of farm workers across the United States daily to work in fields. Authorities are also looking into whether the passengers may have been victims of human smuggling. And Democrats reintroduced legislation Tuesday to require universal background checks for all gun sales. Biden called on Congress last month to pass gun control legislation, but 10 Republican senators would need to join Democrats in backing the expansion of federal background checks for the bill to pass. Meanwhile, another gun control bill was also introduced Tuesday, which would prevent people convicted of domestic violence from buying or owning firearms. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, it's been a devastating year for Asian Americans as hate crimes spiked across the country, fueled by Donald Trump's racist rhetoric about the coronavirus. One recent study found a 150% increase in anti-Asian American hate crimes in 2020, even though overall hate crimes fell last year. Here in New York, police investigated 28 hate crimes in 2020 targeting Asian American, a nine-fold increase over the previous year. On Saturday, the Asian American community, allies, and elected officials rallied in New York City to call for action. This is New York Democratic Congressmember Grace Meng.
We've been taught our entire life to just fit in, just be quiet, don't speak up, be invisible. If you are invisible enough, you will be seen as American. But we are here to say that we will be invisible no more.
No more!
We will speak up.
The rally came after at least two more attacks against Asian Americans were reported in New York. Last week, a 36-year-old Asian man was stabbed while walking down the street. And 61-year-old Filipino-American Noel Quintana was slashed across the face while on the subway. He also spoke at this weekend's rally.
When the train stopped at Bedford, a man came and stood beside me. So after a few minutes, he kicked my bag, and when I look at him, I move away from him so that if my bag touches him or disturb him in any way, it's no longer that case. So a few more minutes, he kicked again my bag. And that's the time when I moved inside the train and told him what's wrong with you. And that was also the time where the train stopped on the next station and opened the door. And before he left, he moved forward toward me and slashed my face. I thought I was punched on the face. But when I saw the box cutter holding on his hand and the reaction of other people in the train, I knew I was lost. And I called for help, but nobody came for help.
61-year-old Filipino-American Noel Quintana speaking at a rally Saturday. One of New York's most popular Chinese noodle shops, Shen Famous Foods, has begun closing early after two of its employees were attacked in recent months. The company's CEO, Jason Wang, spoke to NBC4 in New York.
My employees were attacked, in separate incidents. Both, I believe, are to be racially motivated hate crimes. And, while keeping their identities anonymous, but at the same time sharing light to this, I'm hoping that, you know, this will paint the picture of what is actually going on.
We're joined now by two guests. Ron Kim is a member of the New York State Assembly, representing a district that includes Flushing, Queens, which is home to more than 30,000 Chinese immigrants. And joining us from Oakland, California, is Kim Tran, an anti-racist writer and organizer based in the Bay Area, currently writing a book titled The End of Allyship, A New Era of Solidarity. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Assemblyman Kim, let's begin with you here in New York. Can you talk about this increase in Asian American hate crimes?
Thank you, Amy, for having me on. There's a long history of Asian Americans in this country feeling targeted and scapegoated whenever we experience economic downturns or racial injustice. From Vincent Chin almost 40 years ago, who was murdered because workers lost their jobs to Japanese car manufacturers, took out their anger on him, to the LA riots, when Black and Korean communities were pitted against each other. I think the knee-jerk reaction is to focus on punishing the crime. I get that. It's heartbreaking, and it makes people feel so angry when we see videos of Asian older adults violently attacked. The 20-year-old in me would have gone out with the bat if I witnessed such a crime. When you feel like your people are violently are targeted, the immediate reaction is to respond with more violence, either direct violence or through state-sanctioned violence. This means more policing, more punitive measures. This reaction, Amy, just to be clear, but only solves the symptoms, but do not address the underlying cause of the disease.
And Assemblyman Kim, I'm wondering your sense of the impact, for instance, over the past few years of the remarks by former President Trump talking about the coronavirus as the Chinese flu, and constantly raising issues of China as an adversary and of the United States. I'm wondering to what degree you think these words from the top leader, former leader of the United States, has had an impact on public consciousness.
Of course, it had a tremendous negative impact, you know, but we could respond in three different ways to the current situation. We could point to Donald Trump for fueling attacks on Asians by his Chinese, you know, virus rhetoric. We could increase policing prisons, or we could fix the underlying issues of crime and systemic racism that has pitted people of color against each other. There are plenty of politicians with the first and second reactions, but not enough with the third. I think the third reaction requires much more difficult work, requires investing in people, ending tax breaks for the ultra-rich to recirculate wealth into our marginalized communities, and holding politicians accountable so people's basic needs are met: housing, education, and healthcare.
I'd like to bring Kim Tran into the conversation as well. If you could talk about the situation in the Bay Area and also this issue of the systemic historical nature of anti-Asian sentiment in the United States. I think back, for instance, to the almost forgotten Rock Springs massacre of 1885 in Wyoming. In Wyoming, the Anti-Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Could you talk about some of that historical legacy that we still face?
Absolutely. So when we see anti-Asian violence in the United States in 2020, it's the byproduct of a much longer history of anti-Asian policy and anti-Asian sentiment that stems, as you said, all the way back to 1882, with Chinese people being the first nationally barred country from entry into the United States. That being said, we can see glimpses of that same sentiment from the 1871 massacre of Chinese people here in California, all the way up until the post 9/11 Islamophobic violence in South Asian communities. So anti-Asian violence in America is diffuse. It happens in a lot of different ethnicities and for a lot of different Asian groups, but there is a common sense of racial scapegoating. That being said, there is phenomenal work being done by grassroots organizations and activists here in Oakland, California. So just like Assemblyman Kim said, we need to put our communities first. We need to put resources for our communities first. And here in Oakland, what that looks like is a Chinatown accompaniment program, an ambassador program where folks are accompanying our Asian elders and our Asian seniors through Chinatown safely. It's this really beautiful idea that you can turn to your neighbor and turn to someone that you know to keep you safe. We're also doing work around making sure that we can turn to someone other than police for these safety measures. So Anti-Police Terror Project here in Oakland is, you know, launching its own mobile mental health crisis unit so that we can really rely on each other as opposed to something like police, which can increase violence in communities of color.
Can you talk about the response, Kim Tran, of the violent attacks on you have Vichar Ratanapakti, who is a well-known in his San Francisco neighborhood for his hour-long walks. He had just gotten the vaccine. He was 84 years old, the Thai immigrant. And then you have the 91-year-old man who was shoved to the ground in Oakland, California's Chinatown, and ultimately died. The horror of these and how people have rallied around both the Asian American community and the larger community.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, Amy, because I think whenever you see viral footage of an attack, especially when it's racially motivated, we start seeing movements happen, right? And we saw that all the way back to Rodney King. We saw it again with Alton Sterling and the Black Lives Matter movement. And what we're seeing now is a spotlight on the precarity of being an Asian American person in America. So when we see these really viral images of folks in California, folks in New York, who are incredibly vulnerable, and I want us to keep in mind that these attacks actually happened around a time of celebration for a lot of Asian American communities. These were around Lunar New Year. So it was kind of a gut punch, right, of having these videos start circulating in social media. And we started seeing things like Asian Pacific Environmental Network, APINC out here in Oakland, California, start creating safety nets because we were seeing these attacks over and over again on Facebook, on Twitter.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Assemblyman Kim, could you talk about what's your sense of the response of the New York Police Department to these rash of incidents in New York City? Do you feel the department is properly equipped to be able to handle and identify these kinds of incidents?
Listen, I think we all want to know that when we call 911, that police will show up and protect us. But to hand over everything in terms of addressing the systemic reasons for the violence and hatred to the police is not the solution. That requires much more resources and accountability from elected officials. It's easy to individualize the hatred, to point fingers at the young black and brown teenager who are attacking the Asian older adults and call it a day. It's much harder to go back and improve the social conditions that's brewing the violence. You know, if you just allow the police to handle everything, that is a cop-out by politicians saying we can't address this systemically, so we're just going to take punitive measures and rely on state-backed violence to check the communities who are attacking Asian Americans, and that's not good enough.
I want to go to Connie Won, co-founder of Asian and Pacific Islander Women Lead, speaking at a protest last month.
What about that violence of living in poverty under a system that doesn't seem to care about our people? That's the violence we need to answer to. The vigilantes coming out here calling for more police, I need you to answer to that violence. I want you to represent for that. Our communities are also suffering deportation, answer to that violence. Our people are in detention centers for an indefinite amount of times. I need you there for that too. And then, you're not even accounting for the gender violence that our women are experiencing. I need you to account for that.
That's Connie Wun in Oakland, California. Kim Tran, your final response. And also, do you see an issue of foreign policy? I hate to say the word bleeding into this, but the vilification of China, not only around coronavirus, but in a lot of ways.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of racial scapegoating at the domestic, absolutely, but also the international level, right? The dehumanization and the kind of geopolitical pitting of China against the United States has tremendous repercussions for what we experience socially on the ground. And it also serves as a means of us not talking about those realities that, as Connie Wun from AAPI Women Lead is talking about, the reality that, you know, 30% of people in Chinatown live under the poverty line. I, as a Vietnamese woman, have the same pay gap as a Black woman. And so we're creating certain narratives that make this kind of violence acceptable. And we're creating these certain kinds of ways of substantiating and perpetuating this violence.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Kim Tran, we look forward to reading your book. Kim Tran is an organizer in Oakland, California, currently writing a book called The End of Allyship, A New Era of Solidarity. And Ron Kim, we'd like to ask you to stay with us to address another issue, and that is the future of Governor Andrew Cuomo here in New York. You have a lot to say about a phone call he made to you when you said he threatened you with destroying you. This is around a couple of issues here. We're talking about sexual harassment and also not telling the truth about thousands of COVID-19 deaths in nursing homes. Stay with us.
The man seem to do the worst, but with all he possesses, self-preservation's come first. His damnation comes from not born free, as destruction of the poor is their poverty, is their poverty. Just sorry for me. Cause I've been living in misery. Oppression.
The Oppressed Song by Bunny Wailer, the co-founder of the legendary reggae band The Wailers. He died Tuesday at the age of 73. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the quarantine report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. New York Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo is facing mounting calls to resign or be impeached over sexual harassment allegations and his cover-up of thousands of COVID deaths in New York nursing homes. Many of the calls to resign are coming from fellow Democrats and progressive organizations, including the Working Families Party, which said Tuesday, Andrew Cuomo's reign of fear, harassment, and intimidation cannot continue. New York Attorney General Letitia James has launched an investigation after three women accused Cuomo of sexual harassment. In late February, a former top aide, Lindsay Boylan, accused Cuomo of kissing her during a one-on-one meeting and once suggesting they play strip poker. She described years of sexual harassment by the governor who she claims, went out of his way to touch her lower back, arms, and legs. Another aide, Charlotte Bennett, accused Cuomo of making comments suggesting he wanted to sleep with her. On Sunday, a third woman, Anna Rush, described meeting Cuomo at a friend's wedding reception in 2019. A photograph from the wedding showed Cuomo with his hands on Rush's face as she looks visibly uncomfortable. She says he also grabbed her lower back right before that and loudly asked her if he could kiss her. Cuomo has issued a statement saying his interactions may have been, quote, insensitive or too personal, and that his actions may have been, quote, misinterpreted as an unwanted flirtation, unquote. On Tuesday, top Democrats in New York legislature agreed to move to strip Cuomo of emergency powers granted him during the pandemic. This comes less than a month after New York Attorney General Letitia James accused Cuomo of drastically undercounting the number of COVID deaths in New York nursing homes by as much as 50%, forcing the Cuomo administration to admit the true death toll to be nearly 15,000. The FBI and U.S. attorney in Brooklyn are now probing the cover-up. He's also being accused of secretly giving nursing homes legal immunity. In February, Democratic New York Assembly member Ron Kim, the chair of the Assembly's Committee on Aging, which oversees the nursing homes, revealed Cuomo called him at home and threatened him for speaking out. Kim said Cuomo threatened to, quote, destroy me. New York Assembly member Ron Kim is still with us. Can you explain, first of all, that conversation and what it came out of? Talk about the nursing home scandal and why you feel it's so significant, Assemblyman Kim.
Thank you, Amy. You know, I came forward with that governor's threatening call not because I feared being bullied, but because I feared that the governor would escape accountability. You know, that phone call is less about him being a bully and more so about the length that he would go to use his position of power to implicate lawmakers in covering up for his corruption. You know, he wanted me to issue a statement to feed his narrative on why his administration withheld nursing home data, life and death information, that the delay was because the DOJ inquiry had to be satisfied before the state's questions. That is complete BS. You know, he personally got on the phone to threaten my career, to suppress the truth. He called me that night because he was desperately trying to avoid more investigations into his cover-up of nursing home information and data, you know, and his deadly decisions to transfer 9,000 COVID patients to unprepared nursing home facilities. And the fact that, as you mentioned, Amy, he gave his donors, corporate nursing home executives, an immunity from criminal prosecution at the peak of the pandemic.
Well, Assemblyman Kim, as somebody who has known Governor Cuomo now for more than 30 years, when I heard about the story of what had happened to you was perfectly understandable, because he has always been known as someone who is not only arrogant, but very much of a bully toward his critics. I remember numerous times when, as a columnist at the Daily News, after writing even a mildly critical column of the governor, suddenly getting a call from him and having to endure a tirade of profanities and yelling and screaming from him just because he didn't like a particular article. So this is a perfectly part of his personality. But I'm wondering, in terms of this issue of the nursing homes, how did you first begin to understand the depth of what was happening and to begin to raise questions about this?
Yeah, thank you all for the question. I was on the ground since last year because my constituents were reaching out to me. They couldn't get inside the nursing homes. They knew that COVID was transmitting, and they were seeing their loved ones die of agony alone, and they were desperate for help. As I'm looking at what's going on, I'm reaching out to the governor's office. They're not responding. I'm reaching out to the Department of Health. A week goes by, a month goes by, and there's absolute no accountability and communication. And just around that time, he issues that mandate to send thousands of COVID patients to unprepared nursing homes and issues a corporate legal shield, what I call a license to kill older adults at that time. That's when I started to push back. I introduced a repealer bill, and all of a sudden, the data disappears. It doesn't look that bad. because they delinked the information. They stopped counting the hospital deaths. And all of a sudden, New York went from number two, number three in the country to number 30 or whatever. And it no longer became a hot button issue. And all the while, he goes out there and he writes a book and he publishes it around that same time in October. So all these things, you know, when you look at, when you go back and connect the dots, I think the cover-up, the suppression of information, he took away our right to legislate, our right to repeal some of the toxic bills. He took away our ability to save people's lives. And for that, he needs to be held accountable.
And could you talk a little more about the role of the Greater New York Hospital Association, this a powerful industry group in terms and its support of the governor?
Yeah, Cuomo prioritized the interest of his top corporate donors, including the hospital lobbyists and nursing home lobbyists, over saving lives. His administration admitted to deliberately withholding data. I believe he did this for two reasons. One, because it would make him look bad. And two, to prevent the repeal of his toxic poison bill, which he bullied his way, he forced his way into the last hour in the budget, in the 5,000-page budget, which shielded nursing home executives at the cost of people's lives. For this, again, he needs to be held accountable. 15,000 families deserve justice.
And it was the same legislation that was then copied by many other states around the country. And even the Republicans have been seeking immunity on a much broader scale for other companies as well. Is that not right?
That's right. It became the industry released a press release immediately after it was passed by the governor, bragging that they wrote and put it in the budget. They immediately took down their press release a week after we called them out. But yes, they took the same language from state to state. They literally clicked copy and paste word for word. And Mitch McConnell literally took word for word and tried to put it into the Washington stimulus package. But luckily in Washington, there's a lot more people watching and the public was aware and it never made it out. But in Albany, in the last hour, when no one was paying attention, Governor Cuomo was able to force that language into the budget, where even the chair of the health committee, Dick Godfrey, my good friend, didn't even know. And he reads everything. And he didn't even know it got snuck in the last minute into the budget.
I mean, it's amazing you didn't know, Ron Kim, because you were head of the subcommittee that's in charge of the nursing homes to show how last minute this was. There's a move to strip his executive powers, his expanded powers during COVID. Is there a move to actually just strip that bill, to take it out now, that immunity? And if before we go on to the issue of sexual harassment, the number of families who trusted the system and were told that it would be safe to put their parents in nursing homes, and what exactly he demanded of these nursing homes, that hospitals, that they accept COVID patients from hospitals and then ultimately explain how the cover-up of the numbers of the number of people who died as a result of this decision.
Yeah. Just around that time, when I was on the ground, the nursing homes that I was interacting with, they were screaming. You know, the workers were sick of COVID. Even the directors were out for weeks because they were sick. They were saying, we don't have enough staff. We don't have PPE. You cannot send COVID positives to our facilities. We're not a hospital. But he did it, and he gave them a get-out-of-jail-free card as part of the deal. It was almost as if he normalized the duty of dying for older adults. It almost may feel like these nursing home residents as if their ultimate fate was to die in these facilities. And imagine being a loved one, being stuck outside, seeing this happen, and you're trying to tell the truth. And all you see when you turn the TV on is Andrew Cuomo and his brother cracking jokes on national TV. I mean, it just was one of the most demoralizing moments for my constituents going through that episode in New York. But yes, the suppression of data is so critical, because if we had real-time information, we would have had the data to repeal these toxic bills, to mandate and go the other way, to mandate the for-profit, which, by the way, I mean, 65% of the industry in New York is for-profit nursing homes. We could have mandated them to spend every dollar they had to save people's lives. And if you can come back at the end of the pandemic, and you show the receipts that you spent everything that you had, you did everything to buy PPE and hire staff, and people still died, then we can openly discuss what kind of liability protection we may provide with the families and everyone involved with the public's input. But that's not what had happened today, last year. The legal immunity served as a disincentive for the for-profits to investing further into the staff hiring and buying PPE. It gave them an out to let people die.
So there are calls for his impeachment or resignation just on this issue alone. But then there's the issue, the growing scandal around sexual harassment. Charlotte Bennett, one of the aides who was accused Cuomo of sexual harassment, told the New York Times Monday, as we know, abusers, particularly those with tremendous amounts of power, are often repeat offenders who engage in manipulative tactics to diminish allegations, blame victims, deny wrongdoing, and escape consequences. These are not the actions of someone who simply feels misunderstood. They're the actions of an individual who wields his power to avoid justice. Bennett said Cuomo told her he was open to relationships with younger women. She's in her 20s and complained about being lonely and being unable to hug anyone because of the pandemic. She said, I understood the governor wanted to sleep with me and felt horribly uncomfortable and scared. She shared texts that he texted her with the New York Times. That's one of the three women who've now accused him. Then, of course, there's Lindsay Boylan, his aide in her 30s, who talked about the constant harassment, not only of Cuomo, but messages sent by his aide to her as well. Your response, what do you want to see happen here?
I believe the woman, the credible allegations of sexual harassment made by these courageous women coming forward show a clear pattern of Cuomo's abuse of power. And I believe the governor will be held accountable for sexual harassment. This is a long pattern of toxic behavior that we all know that exists in places like Albany. And at the helm of it all is a person at the top who normalizes verbal abuse against women. Case in point, Even his top aide have called some of my closest progressive young woman colleagues in this legislature, FN idiots on record in New York Times when they called him out for raising having fundraisers with the budget director in the room. These are the type of verbal abuse that he helped normalize, because at the very top, you know, he does it himself in those closed rooms. He cracks jokes. He sexually harasses. He preys on people and abuses his power all the time. And that's why he has an orbit of staff members that reflects his values every single day in his administration. And they all need to be held accountable.
But Assemblyman, I wanted to ask you, the Democrats have a veto-proof majority in both the New York State, in the Senate and the Assembly, but yet there are very few Democrats like yourself who are taking daring to stand up and demand accountability from the governor. What do you think are the prospects for that to change over the next few weeks?
I think you will see changes. I think we're already seeing every day people calling for resignation, more people in a Democratic conference. And I know that people in positions of power, they're making this about Democrats for Republicans. But I tell them that this is about the Democratic conference and our credibility. We spent months telling Republicans in Washington to hold Trump accountable, to do the right thing. And we call them hypocrites. So if we do not act, and if we do not lead in this moment, what are we doing to our values and our credibility? Are we reciprocating their hypocrisy with our hypocrisy?
Are you calling on Governor Cuomo to resign?
I have already called the governor to resign, but resignation doesn't mean accountability. He still needs to be investigated after his resignation.
And if he doesn't resign, will you make a move to impeach him?
I made my case early on to my colleagues of the moment that he tried to implicate my colleagues and the institutions in his wrongdoing. I believe that is a clear case of willful corrupt conduct, which obligates us to pursue the impeachment procedure under the state constitution. There's only a few of us at this point that are moving in that direction, but I believe every day, if he doesn't resign, more will join in the call for impeachment.
Ron Kim, I want to thank you for being with us, member of the New York State Assembly, representing 48th District, chair of the Aging Committee. His recent opinion piece we'll link to in Newsweek. It's time to impeach Andrew Cuomo. Next up, we look at why some of the 2.5 million farm workers around the country are facing an uphill battle to get vaccinated. Stay with us. Yuval Waldman, the conductor and violinist, died last month at the age of 74. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we look at the push to vaccinate some 2.5 million farm workers around the country who are essential workers and have continued to labor throughout the pandemic. Farm workers are mostly Latinx, many undocumented. Their employers do not provide sick leave or health care. This is Itis Figueroa of the Farm Worker Justice addressing the House Appropriations Labor Subcommittee Tuesday.
COVID has had a devastating impact on farm workers. A Purdue University tracker estimates that almost 500,000 agricultural workers have contracted COVID thus far. The study that Chairwoman DeLauro cited found not only that food and agricultural workers have experienced the highest excess mortality in the pandemic compared to other workers, but that increase is even higher, 20% higher for Latino food and agricultural workers.
According to CDC guidelines, farm workers are part of Phase 1B, the second group to receive the vaccine after frontline healthcare workers. California Governor Gavin Newsom has still said the state will provide 34,000 vaccines to farm workers, and thousands are now being vaccinated at pop-up clinics in the fields hosted by growers and run by the county health department. So far, data shows just 16% of vaccines in California have been given to Latinx residents, even though they account for nearly 40% of the state's population. And Black and Latinx Californians are suffering the highest rates of COVID deaths in the state. Meanwhile, here in New York, the news outlet Documented New York reports more than 50,000 farm workers were removed from Phase 1B tier at the last minute, just before New York opened up its vaccine rollouts to other workers, including those in the food industry, like grocery, restaurant, and food delivery workers. And this comes as Colorado, Idaho, Michigan, Wisconsin say they plan to start vaccinating farm workers this month, but some states have restrictions that could deter workers, like Florida, which grows much of the nation's citrus fruit, where people must prove residency to get a vaccine. The New York Times reports some pharmacies in Georgia have turned away immigrants unable to show a social security number, and officials in Nebraska say immigrant workers who lack legal status at meatpacking plants will be vaccinated last. For more, we go to Modesto, California, where we're joined by Estela Cisneros, Agricultural Worker Program Legal Director at California Rural Legal Assistance. Also with us in Ithaca, New York, Mary Jo Dudley, Director of the Cornell Farm Worker Program, faculty member in the Department of Global Development at Cornell University. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Estela Cisneros, let's begin with you. Lay out the issue in California. Who's getting vaccinated? Who's not?
Right now, farm workers are eligible to be vaccinated. Farm workers became eligible to be vaccinated right after healthcare workers and those aged 65 or over. There's other workers that are included in this group as well, teachers, other food industry workers, childcare workers, as well as emergency services personnel. Those are the workers that are currently eligible to be vaccinated in the state. There's been problems, however, with the way that vaccines are distributed statewide. They are run by the different counties, especially the public health departments. And there's been a lot of inequities that we've seen throughout counties because of the decision by the governor to put people aged 65 or over before individual employment sectors. That was originally the intent, as the CDC recommended, but that was a last-minute change in the state as well.
And could you talk about the issue of being able to schedule a vaccine appointment, since so much of this is being done online and sometimes in extremely complex forms you have to fill out online, the impact that this has on farm workers that are living basically in rural areas, maybe don't even have internet accessibility. Could you talk about those who are trying to help farm workers get on the list of eligible vaccine recipients and to get appointments?
Definitely. That has been a challenge in a lot of counties. Some counties are only allowing appointments to be made online. Some local pharmacies that are now supplying the COVID vaccine are also only making appointments online. That's a huge barrier to individuals who have either little technology literacy or who lack access to broadband services or other reliable internet or cell phone services. There's also been issues with call centers where people can make appointments by phone, not having either Spanish speaking or in the case of farm workers in California, individuals who speak Mexican indigenous languages. So there's just the barrier of actually making an appointment once agricultural workers become aware that they are eligible. There's that challenge that we've definitely seen expressed throughout the different counties in the state.
And can you talk about the situation specifically in Riverside County in California, a county that's nearly 50% Hispanic, and it's become the first, according to the New York Times, the first in the nation to prioritize farm workers for vaccination?
Definitely. In that area, what appears to be happening is there appears to be a pretty strong connection between the local public health department and employers in terms of providing either pop-up vaccination efforts or other similar efforts like that to actually bring vaccines into the fields. That's the first county that I am aware of that is doing a program like that. In most other counties, it falls on the local public health departments. In some other counties, there's also collaborations between local clinics and other service providers that have a deep connections to the farm worker community. But in Riverside, it does appear to be that that's certainly being exemplified as a really good example of what we need to do statewide. And that's certainly something that we would love to see replicated in other counties that are still struggling to vaccinate farm workers. Riverside does have a significant farm worker population, but actually there's more farm workers in other counties throughout the state, specifically in the Central Valley. That's actually where Governor Newsom a week ago made an announcement that he was actually going to allow and promote 11 pop-up vaccination sites in the Central Valley specifically to address that concern, which is that there's a lot more farm workers that live there, and they have really struggled with not just vaccine access, but also the distribution of the vaccine. It did seem like for some time the vaccine distribution was being done by the number of healthcare providers in each county. And so in one county in the Central Valley, for example, they had the second lowest vaccine distribution numbers, even though they had the fifth highest number of COVID-related deaths. the change in provision of pop-up vaccination sites will hopefully address that concern, but also the governor has said that more vaccines are going to come to that area because it's essentially a twofold problem. It's not just do you have enough vaccines, but also do you have the infrastructure to actually be able to provide those vaccines to the population that you're trying to reach.
And Mary Jo Dudley, you're head of the Cornell Farm Worker Program. Can you explain what happened? The CDC guidelines include farm workers in the list of frontline essential workers now eligible to get the vaccine in Phase 1B. That's like corrections workers, food and agricultural workers, U.S. Postal Service, grocery store workers, et cetera, as well as daycare workers. But at the last minute, the state of New York removed farm workers from that list?
Thank you, Amy. It's very puzzling because on February 9th, President Biden set aside an additional 11 million vaccines for underserved and vulnerable populations, among them farm workers, homeless individuals, limited English proficiency communities, and those living in public housing. So this would bring additional vaccines to New York State. It would not diminish the number currently coming. But the problem right now is that farm workers are not included on the list of those eligible to receive COVID-19 vaccines in New York State at a time where we see an increasing number of cases of COVID among the farm worker population. And we've seen farm workers, farm worker-led organizations such as Alianza Agricola, advocacy groups, healthcare providers, and farmers have all been calling upon the governor to add farm workers to the list of those eligible. And the response is puzzling that this hasn't happened yet.
And how would these vaccines be distributed to farm workers in New York State? Are there distribution centers already being set up?
Yes, Juan, thank you for that question, because these vaccines would be distributed directly to the federally qualified health centers, and among them are the migrant health centers. So they would go directly to those centers that have the language abilities, cultural competency, 20 or more years of experience in giving vaccines, and the equipment which would allow them to go to farms to administer the vaccines. It's important that these vaccines would go to those centers because they are already known and trusted by the farm worker population, and they know where the farm workers live. So we've had a lot of interest, offers of farmers to make their farm a pop-up site, but we don't have the vaccines. And until farm workers are added to the list, vaccines cannot be administered to them in New York State.
You've interviewed dozens of farm workers. What have been their experience with COVID-19? Many sick.
Many sick, and it's very distressing that many of them have experienced long-term symptoms such as headaches, dizziness, and this long-haul COVID among the farm worker population is very worrisome, since they wouldn't have any access to a security net, a social security net, a backup net, and they continue to feel ill after having recovered from COVID.
I want to thank you both for being with us. In the U.S., we call it long haulers, and the rest of the world, they call it long COVID, those that suffer from COVID for many, many months since they have gotten it. Mary Jo Dudley, director of the Cornell Farm Worker Program, faculty member at Cornell's University's Department of Global Development, and Estela Cisneros, speaking to us from Modesto, California, legal director of the California Rural Legal Assistance's Agriculture Worker Program. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriano Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy birthday. Happy first birthday, Miles.